Here we are again, week two. Jeremy Hymans is in the studio with me, Tony Nash, and we're talking about New Power, a book that he has written, co-written with Henry Timms. It's an international bestseller, and we're gonna kick off where we were. We're just talking about some of the models that we have around the world, and things are changing. When you sit from your position now, that because the idea has, you've been on, you've had a TED talk, you do lots of presentations, I assume, all over the world, large crowds, small crowds. What are some of the things that you've noticed post the book, and people have reached out to you and you've heard some inspiring, because when you, a lot of the examples are really classic stories that you've been able to use as demonstrations of why New Power is actually operational now, and this is why some companies are succeeding and being worth billions of dollars or $1 trillion, like Apple and Amazon. What do you see? What have you heard recently that's quite inspiring? You go, someone listened and read our book and they did something.
Well, look, a lot of the most inspiring examples are in things like the health sector. So you've got, frontline health workers in big systems like Medicare or, the NHS in Britain, and they are feeling really disempowered. They're feeling overwhelmed by bureaucracy. What they want to do is they want to get closer to their patients. They know that if their patients feel like they're more empowered, that there'll be better health outcomes. So we've heard these amazing stories of people taking the frameworks in the book and using them to change the way their hospital works. Or the way getting their patients to form support groups with each other to kind of talk through some of the issues that they're having and to take control of their own health. Things like that have been happening all over the world. It's been amazing. So in Britain, the NHS, as you know, the National Health Service, is one of the largest employers in the world. I think it's just behind the Red Army, number three or number four. And people there have just taken New Power and run with it. And they haven't just run with it, they've improved it. And that's the cool thing as well. There's another example, one of the most famous activists coming out of the Arab Spring, a guy called Wael Ghanim. He was, at the time, a Google employee who started the first big protest in Tahrir Square in Egypt and became the sort of symbol of the Arab Spring. He took one of the frameworks in the book, which he really liked, and he redesigned it, adapted it, and published it to his 3 million followers and got a whole bunch of other people playing with the idea, changing it, etc. And that's really the message of the book as well, which is that people who create ideas that are what we call extensible, they're remixable, they're changeable, people can make them their own, those are the ideas that are spreading. Think about Me Too as a movement. Part of what made Me Too so powerful is everybody could make it their own. Everybody could add their own testimony. They could adapt it to the place that they were in, the industry they were working. And so it was owned by everyone.
That's amazing. So the way that you're describing it, it's the New Power concept is actually the New Power definition, in that you guys have no copyright around it. Mm-hmm. There's no like, hey, we invented this way of thinking, so yes, therefore we're going to get a royalty.
No, definitely not.
If I was to kind of go back in time to go, well, what happened? Tim Berners-Lee and the guys that started getting the internet to kind of be connected,
yes,
had that by a freak of circumstances being started, controlled by old power, then maybe we wouldn't be having this conversation, because
definitely
because the internet is very much and the way that it
the principles on which it was built.
Yeah, it's all about there's no one that has true rights and ownership at all, and that's really like the stimulus for thinking, in terms of if someone was to go, well, how can I make use of this? It's really actually kind of going out in the world and just wandering and walking around and talking to people and going, okay, where is this all happening, or what framework. I've certainly done it with Booktopia, or at least we have. But in terms of my own personal thinking and journey, it's like publishing is a 550-year-old industry.
Yes,
and therefore I could see that the publishers decided what you were going to read, how you might read that, in what format, when you'd read it, and reject anything that they didn't think you should read.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I could see that the customers actually had the power, or were getting the power. Mm-hmm. They could choose what price they wanted to buy it for, because they didn't have to buy it locally anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And in Australia, we had very high book prices for decades, because of where we were actually physically located in the world, whereas America and Europe, UK, was much cheaper. So I could see that it was all about focusing on what the customer wanted, to then be able to build our model to focus on them, which was no one else did or saw. They actually could not even, and because I came out from outside of the book industry, it was logical and obvious to me.
Sort of fresh eyes. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas everyone else, well, that's, I don't know, that's not how you do it. This is how we've always done it. And so therefore it was quite surprising to me to be able to see the world operating like that. And and it wasn't as if there weren't others doing it. Of course Amazon was involved and others were doing it. Already, but so there was, and I never obviously didn't think about new power. I hadn't thought about what, it was the way the world was working. So when does new power become power, and then new power becomes old power? is that
well? It's a great point. And to take the example of the internet itself, as you were saying, so Tim Berners-Lee created this thing that was based on these incredibly radical new power principles, because it wasn't obvious that you would create something that was completely open, that no one owned, etc. And they did all of that. Think about the principles on which email was based, right? So email was built as what's called an open protocol. So it didn't matter what your email provider was, they could all talk to each other seamlessly. So the fact that you have Hotmail and I have Gmail doesn't prevent us from talking to each other. Now, what happened with the internet, to your point about how new power can sometimes become old, is that people took that, but then they started building these walled gardens inside of it. So you think about Facebook. The problem with Facebook is that once you're in that walled garden, you can only communicate with the people inside of it, and it's very hard to leave. And you can't communicate with people on other platforms seamlessly. So you've created this model in which Facebook has actually started to extract a lot of the value that used to be in these open systems. And that's not necessarily good for consumers. So in the book, we talk about Facebook as a kind of co-opter model. They're incredibly good at new power. They're great at getting people to participate. We're all participating at an incredible level there. There's 2 billion people on the platform. But their values, their approach, is very much about extracting the most that they can from us, not making it easy for us to leave, not making it easy for that kind of seamless interoperability between platforms. And that's the problem with the modern internet. And so one of the things we talk about is how can we bring the internet back to some of those first principles? Because we're all losing out in that new world. Because in the world of Facebook, we don't share in all that economic value created. We don't even know what that algorithm is. The algorithm has such a role now in what we see and feel and our political opinions and the friends that we engage with and the ones that we don't. We can't control that. Facebook does. It's like Colonel Sanders' secret herbs and spices.
Mm.
And that's a problem for democracy, and it's a problem for all of us getting on with our lives. But we should have the ability to choose which friends we can communicate with easily and, you know, whose posts we see, what opinions we want to be exposed to, and we can't.
That's interesting because with Booktopia, we often talk about this, that we don't really look at our competitors. They're there in our peripheral vision, but we're not focusing on what they do to try and combat that. We don't think about Amazon in that way.
Yeah.
We just focus on what the customer wants.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk sometimes about the pricing of books and that, you know, sometimes it could be that, well, why don't we, you know, we are cheap, not always the cheapest, But yep. maybe we could just increase it by $1 or $2, and that way we can extract more margin from the customers. And but then there's this underlying principle, philosophy, belief that well, if you do that, and then you try and extract just the optimum as much as you can out of your customer, that you've actually opened up for someone else to come in and then potentially take over because they can compete at that price. They just couldn't compete at the price that we were at.
Right.
And for us, it's always not about just being the cheapest. It's actually having it here. So we've got 13,000 square meters, or if you're overseas, 140,000 square feet.
Yeah.
With 150,000 titles in stock ready to go. A lot of the time we're not the cheapest, but we have it here. It's ready to ship. We've committed to it. Versus someone else who might be cheaper, but it's got to come from overseas and it's going to not be tracked and it's going to be slow, but they'll save a few dollars. And quite often we find that that's not actually the preferred outcome for a customer.
That's right.
So, so therefore with the likes of Facebook, which of course they've got shareholders, it has a value. They need to work out that the shareholders want to know that they're going to be, delivered either dividends or they're going to have the capital that they've invested increase. So they actually do need to work out ways to make money.
Mm-hmm.
But what that does do in a similar way, it does open up for someone else to come in to go, well, actually, the faults in your system we can address because actually that's not what people want. The way that you control that, I can build a better system and therefore Facebook is exposed, or we all are always exposed, and therefore it's up to all of us to continually challenge our model to make sure that there's not someone else inventing something else
that can
surpass whatever you've accomplished. And
that takes a fair
amount of free thinking to ensure that you don't sit on your laurels, you don't become entitled. That's the challenge.
Absolutely. So hearing you talk, you're displaying a lot of what we would describe in the book as new power values. So to unpack that a little bit, first, you're being super transparent with people about what you're doing. You're saying, well, this is how it works and we're a little bit more expensive sometimes for this reason. And this is how we think about it. That's a very different approach to the way a lot of business leaders play things. They spin. You know, there's a corporate line that actually bears no resemblance to reality. So leaders who have that kind of radical transparency with their consumers are doing very well in this environment, even when sometimes you're telling them stuff that they don't want to hear. I think the second thing that is interesting to draw out is I would imagine that part of the reason that you don't increase the price by a couple of dollars, you're also trying to keep faith with your consumers and build a community around it. You're dependent on the goodwill of those people. And I imagine you're also dependent on them to write reviews, to engage, to be the kind of messengers of the product that you sell, which is such an intimate product, the book. And so if people feel like you're being transactional with them, they'll be transactional with you. And again, so that's a strategy that in a new power world often works a lot better than just squeezing your community for as much value as you can get. You know, there is a story we tell in the book of Uber. Uber has a very transactional relationship with its drivers and its riders. You know, it won't, for example, even let its drivers talk to each other for fear that they will start organizing against it. There's a competitor to Uber in the US that hasn't arrived in Australia yet called Lyft, L-Y-F-T, and they are very big in the US now, the number two player. And they're built on the opposite principle. So they actually encourage their drivers to engage with each other. They get them organizing picnics with each other. They get a lot of input from their drivers on policy changes, even policy changes that are hard news. So when, you know, for example, when Uber lowered its prices, Lyft had to follow, otherwise it wouldn't be competitive, right? But when they did that, they went to their drivers and they said, okay, we have to do this, but what can we do to make up for it? What are some of the things that would make a difference for you? And they created a bunch of other things, benefits around that, that was a totally different approach the way Uber did it, which was on a Friday afternoon, they just told people prices going down, tough luck. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these are all different strategies. And the Uber strategy is a very old power approach in mindset, you know. And the question is, that might have worked really well in general 50 years ago. But now I think people expect more, and they're expecting a different kind of engagement.
So with, I mean, it'd be nice to be able to go into the future and be able to look back. But I remember hearing a story that when cars were originally invented, there were around, in the early 1900s, in the first decade of the 1900s, and there were 50 IPOs, publicly listed capital raisings for car companies that never made it, never existed. So are there some of these, and could there be, and I'm sure there's plenty of examples, but companies like Uber, who are so huge today, but by having these methods or processes of building and running their company, that they actually they're fraught with with potential eventually imploding or being overtaken. Is that a possibility?
It is. I mean, I think there's a little bit of live by new power, die by new power. So if your model depends on a community of people, a relationship with them, the participation of many people, then you have to feed that community. So Airbnb's done this very well. They've built this very close relationship with the hosts. The hosts, they have annual conferences where they bring their hosts together, the most active hosts. They create real community among them. They share, this is how you be a good host. They really have built something with them, which means then when they're in a regulatory fight, because governments all over the world are challenging Airbnb at the moment, at the city level usually, their hosts are often showing up and knocking on doors for them to try to fight back some of the legislation that is encroaching. And imagine Hilton Hotels getting its consumers to do their corporate lobbying for it. You can't, right? So that teaches you something about, you know, that approach. So yeah, I think that's a big dynamic now.
Amazing. Well, we've come to the end. I know the conversation is going so super fast. I'm loving it. Thank you. End of episode 2, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back for episode 3 next week.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.